is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This was not a crisis. And in fact, it was the military that has been creating a narrative about there being a crisis in the past month and growing tensions and growing crime and other challenges, which they then blamed on the civilians and then used as a pretext for their dissolution of the transition government.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, saying Sudan's military has been building a case to justify a takeover. Details coming up. Also, thousands of Burundian refugees returning home after years of exile. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A Sudanese military official said General Abdel Fattah Burhan has fired at least six ambassadors who spoke out against the military's takeover. They included the envoys to the U.S., the European Union, France, and three U.N. missions. The African Union described Monday's military takeover as an unconstitutional seizure of power and has reportedly suspended Sudan's membership until civilian rule is restored. The World Bank Wednesday also suspended Sudan. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with deposed Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who was released from custody Tuesday. The U.S. and other foreign powers are calling for a return to the civilian-led transition to democracy. Meanwhile, journalist Michael Atit in the Sudanese capital Khartoum says it is difficult for citizens to move around in the capital due to heavy security deployment. Ruling General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has defended the army's seizure of power in Sudan, saying he was trying to avoid civil war. Burhan accused politicians of incitement against the armed forces. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed the military takeover and the alleged justification of it with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Civilians in Sudan are not a threat to the army, even in the massive protests of 2019. These were very peaceful. And during the transition process, it's not the civilians who've had the weapons. They're not being threats. So this was not a crisis. And in fact, it was the military that has been creating a narrative about there being a crisis in the past month and growing tensions and growing crime and other challenges, which they then blamed on the civilians and then used as a pretext for their dissolution of the transition government. So this appears to be a highly choreographed effort on the part of the military to rationalize their coup effectively.
The military takeover brought a halt to Sudan's transition to democracy 2 years after a popular uprising toppled long-ruling autocrat Omar al-Bashir. Al-Burhan said the military's action did not amount to a coup, and the army move aims to correct the course to a transition and a new government that would be formed with no typical politicians. What does that mean in terms of commitment by the military to the democratic transition in Sudan?
Regardless of what General Burhan calls it, this was a coup, the military taking over the government, and it isn't in the military's authority to decide if, when, and how to derail the transition. So having just dissolved the transition process, the military doesn't have much credibility in claiming that it can now lead the transition. And in fact, I think it just exposes the military's unwillingness to allow civilians to lead the government in Sudan. Let's remember that the military has been in control of government in Sudan for all but 10 years since Sudan's independence in 1956. And so they have many vested interests in continuing that process. Their political interest, their economic interest, where the military is estimated to control some 250 different businesses and so generate significant revenues. The military doesn't want to face scrutiny for the alleged human rights abuses they committed during the Bashir regime. And so I think effectively this move means that the military government is a continuation of the Bashir regime. We've had the interlude here for the last 2 years. years of this attempted transition, but with the military seizing power now, it really is a continuation of the mindset and structures that we had in place under Bashir.
Western countries have denounced the coup, called for the detained cabinet ministers to be freed, and said they will cut off aid if the military does not restore power sharing with civilians. U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, said Washington is deeply alarmed over the reports of the military takeover, adding that it puts U.S. assets at risk. Would such pressure deter the military leaders in Sudan and push them to restore the democratic transition?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. However, Sudan is facing a sort of economic crisis. This has been a crisis that's been developing for years because of the economic mismanagement and corruption of the Bashir regime. Sudan, you know, currently faces inflation of over 400%. Sudan has a huge debt estimated to be up to $1.2 trillion by 2025. This is for a country with a GDP of about, $20-25 billion. So these problems are not going away, and they will only grow worse, and it'll create even more social economic pressure. The only way those are going to be resolved is if there's extensive Western economic engagement. And so it appears that by dissolving the transition, Burhan has decided to act to preserve the short-term interest of the military, but in process, he hasn't considered the medium-term interest of the country, nor for that matter is he considered the internal interest of the military, which is now going to have to own all of these problems and try to find solutions for which it doesn't have the resource to address.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague Mohamed El-Shenawi. An Ethiopian government spokesman says a new airstrike has hit the capital of the country's Tigray region. The medical director of the local hospital said 6 people, including 3 children, were killed and more than 20 were injured. The government spokesman told the Associated Press that the target was a site in Mekelle used by the rival Tigray forces to make and repair weapons. But the Tigray spokesman said it struck a civilian residence. The government made several airstrikes on Mekelle last week as the year conflict drags on. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 60,000 Burundian refugees have voluntarily returned home this year, ending years of exile in 5 neighboring countries. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The election of Burundi's then-president Pierre Nkurunziza to a controversial third term in 2015 triggered a mass exodus of refugees from the country. Observers say it took another presidential election in May 2020 to persuade thousands of refugees it was safe to go home. Evariste Ndayishimiye took office on June 20th, following the death of Nkurunziza earlier that month. The UN Refugee Agency says the voluntary assistance program, which began in 2017, has been gathering pace after the country's elections in 2020. UNHCR spokeswoman Amantu says her agency remains concerned about reports of human rights violations in Burundi and is working to ensure that repatriation takes place safely and with dignity.
This is why we are only assisting those who have made a free and informed decision to return. And we continue to advocate to make sure that they do have the information they need. Returns, as I mentioned, are free, informed and voluntary, and continue our advocacy to ensure that borders also remain open and people have access to asylum if they need it.
A convoy carrying 343 Burundian refugees returned to the country from Uganda earlier this week, bringing the total number of voluntary returns to more than 60,000 this year. The UNHCR reports about half that number have returned from Tanzania, with the rest coming from Rwanda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Kenya. Mantu says the repatriation operation is moving along in a quick and organized fashion. She says convoys of around 1,500 refugees arrive in Burundi every week.
On arrival at one of the 5 reception centers, returning families are given household items and cash assistance to help them restart their lives. However, more support is needed to achieve sustainable reparation for these individuals that are returning, as well as for the communities in Burundi receiving them. Often the required social and economic infrastructure is lacking.
The UNHCR reports it has received just 10% of the $104.3 million it needs to support return and reintegration in Burundi. It notes this is a problem given the increasing numbers of people going home. Since 2017, more than 180,000 Burundi refugees have voluntarily returned home. However, nearly 270,000 Burundian refugees remain in exile. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In some parts of northern Nigeria, phone network and internet blockages are entering the third week, and most residents are not happy with the disruptions. From Abuja, reporter Munachi Chuks takes a look at the impact.
President Muhammadu Buhari responded to the NSAS protests with a speech 1 year ago, promising a number of reforms. They include the ban on the special anti-robbery squad and promised to penalize air officers. He also said the government would set up judicial panels of inquiry in all 36 states that will be chaired by retired high court judges and would include youths and members of civil society groups. To date, many but not all states have named their panels. Protesters had also called for the government to compensate families with members who had been tortured and killed by the police and have officers who had worked in the SARS unit to be psychologically evaluated before being reassigned to other work. They also called for an increase in pay for police in an effort to end corruption. But observers say expectations that the government would urgently initiate comprehensive reforms to end police misconduct have not been implemented. Frank Tete, a human rights and development lawyer in Abuja, expressed disappointment.
1 year after, sadly, nothing has changed in the character and modus operandi of the National Police of Nigeria that is exclusively controlled by the federal government. The story of widespread human rights violation and general impunity have remained on the increase despite the NSAS protest of last year.
Tete labels the state's judicial units set up by the government as make-believe.
The various NSAS panels of inquiry that were set up across the country to hear individual complaints of human rights violations by the Special Anti-Robbery Squad of the Nigerian Police were largely by many Nigerians as a mere charade. This view is also shared by many policemen who believe that nothing will come out from the panels.
Civil rights activist Okechukwu Nwangoma urges Nigeria citizens to continue demanding for reforms to better the country.
Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. If citizens remain vigilant and steadfast in demanding reforms, then reforms must happen. Civil society must continue to lead the charge in pushing for far-reaching reforms. The NSAS campaign was a mere spark for the more comprehensive police reform that is long overdue.
The international watchdog Human Rights Watch says hope's ability remain inconclusive and bleak. Nigerians want officials to tackle the systematic problems that foster a culture of impunity in the security sector and push forward with comprehensive and meaningful reforms to end the abuses and injustices Nigerians are still experiencing. The police spokesperson refused repeated requests to speak with the VOA. For VOA News, Munachi Chuks.
The European Union has asked Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, to shelve the death penalty pan-national referendum on the issue. Botswana remains the only southern African country that practices capital punishment. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mukandisi Dube has details.
Jean Sadek, the head of European Union delegation to Botswana, says they asked Masisi to set aside the death penalty ahead of a constitutional review exercise.
It is, of course, up to the government of Botswana to decide on the time frame for the abolition of the death penalty. I suggested that in the meantime, a moratorium on the application of the death penalty could be established. As a first step, this would welcome the launch of a broad debate on the abolition of the death penalty, as the government has already agreed to launch such a debate in the Universal Periodic Review of the UN Human Rights Council in January 2018. Such an exercise is important, as it allows all of an input and to become aware of all aspects of the issues, which in the end can produce a change in public opinion.
DEC says the death penalty goes against Botswana's democratic ideals.
Botswana rightly counts amongst the leading democracy in the world. The application of the death penalty by the government of Botswana is thus misaligned with its democratic credentials and the fact that the world, including states with lesser democratic uprightness, is moving towards abolition. Botswana was the only country in the southern African region still applying the death penalty.
The Botswana delegation presented the country's report on the human rights before the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva last week. The Minister of Presidential Affairs, Gabo Morayeng, who led the delegation, says the people's views will have to be considered if the death penalty is to be abolished. Local human rights group Ditshwanelo has been at the forefront of anti-death campaign. Ditshwanelo's Thapelo Ndlovu says the organization made a representation to the UN Human Rights Council.
We will want to actually the death penalty has no place in the modern times. It denies people the opportunity to actually have a second look or a third look. It is a final decision that ends someone's opportunity to clean his name or her name. We beg the council to ask the government what really motivates the death penalty at this time.
Since independence in 1966, Botswana has executed 38 people, the majority convicted for murder without extenuating circumstances. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habroni, Botswana.
France will return 26 works of art to Benin late this month in fulfillment of a 2017 pledge made by French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron attended an official farewell ceremony yesterday at the Quai Branly Museum, where the cultural objects are currently exhibited. Macron said the handling over the art pieces represented an opportunity for the people of Africa to be able to speak their truth through their artifacts. The 26 pieces from the collection known as the Abomey Treasures were looted by French colonial forces in 1892. Analysts say restitution of the artifacts marks a potential milestone in the fight by African countries to recover work looted by Western explorers and colonizers in the 19th century. Reporter Catherine Field, who is in Paris, visited the exhibition. She told Jackson and Fungani that Western museums have often resisted calls to return African art to their countries of origin, arguing that they lack the necessary infrastructure to safely store and care for the works.
These specific artifacts are 26 pieces that are on display at the moment in the Musée Quai Branly here in Paris. They include three royal statues from the royal kingdom of Dahomey. These are beautiful hybrid figures, half man, half animal, absolutely stunning carving in there. There's a wooden throne that represents the king surrounded by his servants, particularly stunning because it was a single piece of wood. You've got four palace doors from the palace of Obamey. You've got a throne, a sculpted throne, and you've got various Wara staff. So these are pieces that many of them were looted and then were handed over to the museums here in France when they came back at the end of the 19th century. And the idea is now that these 26 artifacts will, sometime later this month, be handed back to Benin. The paperwork will all get done and they will then head home.
They'll be shipped off to Benin, formerly Dahomey. Now, the cultural minister in Benin says that the 26 pieces do not represent all their requests. Do we know anything about the other artwork that is not part of these 26 pieces? And is France planning to return the other artwork?
Well, that has been the big criticism of French President Emmanuel Macron. Remember back in 2017, he made that landmark speech to students in Ouagadougou, where he said that what he really wanted was for African youth to be able to have access to their heritage in Africa, not in Europe. And it is known that there are at least 90,000 artifacts from sub-Saharan Africa in France alone. And in fact, at the Musée Quiberonly, they say they've got about 70,000 artifacts there. So they say they are slowly going through the process of working out which ones really were stolen, which ones should stay here because they were a gift. But you know, the bottom line is that there is a debate here in France as well as to whether or not they should go back. Mm. They say it's against the law. There are laws in France which stop pieces of artifacts, art, anything, leaving French museums and leaving the country. And that is why there is this law that only came in December 2020 that allows these 26 artifacts to go back. So a long way to go yet.
Is Benin the only country whose artwork is being returned? Are they considering returning other artwork that might be in their possession?
They are talking about it. But you again, we're looking at a speech, a promise back in 2017, and very few actual pieces have been handed back. There's been a sword handed back to Senegal. There's going to be later this year, the talking drum will be returned to Côte d'Ivoire. So yes, big gestures, big talk, but very little actually being sent back. Mm. Another reason the French say they're not sending them back yet is that they want to make sure that these pieces are well preserved when they return. And that's why you've got two curators from Benin actually at the Quiberonly Museum in Paris at the moment, looking at these works of art, learning more about how they're going to be presented when they go home.
That was reporter Catherine Field speaking to VOA's Jackson and Fungani from Paris. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.